I'm trying to decide which of your classes I enjoyed most today. Both had a lot to commend them. Thank you for that. When Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth," the people who were listening to him, if they only heard that phrase, could have thought that he meant a number of different things, and the commentators seemed to be at least equally divided in what he may have meant. Some people think that when Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth," he had purity in mind. They will say, "What color is salt? Salt is white. White is the symbol of purity." Some people think that Jesus was connecting salt with verse 8 of Matthew 5, "Blessed are the pure in heart." And certainly we are to be examples of purity. We are to hold up God's pure standard in thought and speech and action. But I don't think that every time Jesus talked about something white, that necessarily meant that he was referring to purity. He talked about whited sepulchers, for example, and he wasn't talking about purity when he talked about whited sepulchers. The whiteness there didn't really have a good connotation at all. So if he is connecting purity with the whiteness of salt here, I don't think that's his main point. Another thought from the commentators is that he's talking about flavor. You flavor the world by being salt. Without you, the world is tasteless, would be the thought there. And I agree that there is a sense in which we flavor the world. 1 Corinthians 7 says that an unbelieving spouse is sanctified by a Christian mate. But I'll tell you this much, I sure don't think the world thinks of us as salt. The world seems to think that we make the world tasteless. They have connected Christianity with that which takes the flavor out of life. Oh, I don't want to be a Christian. You can't do anything. Seems to be the general idea. Like Swinburne, who wrote, "Thou hast conquered, O pale Galilean. The world has grown gray from thy breath." That's quite a statement, that you have lulled the world into gray by being Jesus Christ. Although there is a sense in which we are symbols of purity in the world and we do flavor the world, I don't think that's quite dead center on to the Lord's thought about the salt of the earth. A third option is that salt stings. It has a medicinal healing property when it is put into a wound. Some would say Christians are not supposed to be honey to soothe the sinful world. We're to be salt in the world, and salt sometimes stings. And they would point to 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, which says, "For we are unto God a sweet savor of Christ, unto them that are saved and unto them that perish. To the one we are the savor of death unto death, and to the other the savor of life unto life." In other words, we're to be honey to the believers, but confrontational salt to the unbelievers. And there are times to be confrontational and be salt in the wounds of the world. There are times that I have had to say, "No, I can't marry you because you don't have a right to marry each other." I almost got my nose broken over that one night. Salt stings in the wound. People don't like to hear these things. But I don't think that's all there is to it if the Lord intended this. The salt that the Lord is talking about has some function that he's thinking of as he says this. Another function of salt is to create thirst. Salt in your body creates thirst and makes you drink fluids that will help you to survive. Without salt in food, it would be improper intake of liquid on your part. And when there's improper take of liquid, there's dehydration causing sickness or death. And that was particularly true in the desert countries around the land where the Lord was saying this in the first place. Working outside in the hot summertime, we often used to take salt tablets to replenish the salt that was lost through perspiration. And there is this sense that we create thirst in the world. Sometimes people say, "What is it that you've got? How can you have such peace in this situation or that? Where does your contentment come from?" That's creating a thirst. Salt will do that. They may not like our theology, they may not want our Christ, but they can see in us a lifestyle that makes them thirst for what Jesus brings. Is that what Jesus is talking about? Well, I really think there could possibly be elements of all of these possibilities. We ought to be white and pure in the world and flavor it and sting it at times. We should make the world thirsty for God because our lives are rich and full. But personally, I think that the key reason that he called us salt is this fifth reason, and that is that salt is a preservative, as I mentioned this morning. This is the real reason, the big reason, I think. They rubbed salt into the meat to saturate it and thereby preserve it. And we are an antiseptic preservative in the world to retard the spread of the corruption in the world. If it weren't for Christians in the world, it would be a lot more corrupt than it even is now. So we preserve it. So as we live a holy Christ-like character in the world and are white and do flavor and do sting and make the world thirsty, to all of that in combination can be added the fact that we preserve the world from going completely corrupt. We check the rottenness and decay of the world. And he says the only way we're ever going to be able to do that is if our salt still has its savor. Our presence in the world is to hold back crimes, crimes against God and man. Our presence in the world changes certain kinds of conversations when we step into a room. Our Christianity ought to affect barber shops and beauty shops. It ought to, as we pass through the world, be like the way that goddess was that I mentioned in our beginning this morning. Everywhere we step, flowers bloom. That's the kind of thing that he's talking about. Our presence should condemn apostasy. Our presence should affect the way that people think. It's amazing how people will alter their conversations in the workplace when some of you come into the area. And I've been told various stories about this. You know, in the 18th chapter of the book of Genesis, verse 23, God was at a decision-making point, or at least he let Abraham think that he was. Abraham said, will you destroy the righteous with the wicked, as Jack was pointing out this morning? Will you destroy the righteous with the wicked? Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? What if there are 50 righteous people down there in that valley? Will you still destroy those towns? No. If there's 50, I will spare those towns for the sake of 50. And Abraham said, well, I'm just dust and ashes, but I've taken it upon me to speak. What if there are 45? If they're 45, I won't destroy them. You know this story very well. Down to 40 and 30 and 20. Lord, please don't be angry, said Abraham, but what about 10? I won't destroy it for the sake of 10 righteous people. Just 10 righteous people could have preserved the towns in that whole valley, that entire population. 5 towns, Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah and Zeboam and the little city of Zoar. That's an average of only 2 righteous people per town to spare those places. Christians in the world preserve the world from the wrath of God. We are an agency to delay God's inevitable judgment. And if we're going to do that, we cannot live the way the world lives. We are an agency for good. We're the only salt in the whole earth. And as indwelt by the Holy Spirit of God, we are the only restraint in the rotten carcass of humanity. It's amazing how God uses something as humble and simple and basic as us. God gives noble purposes to ignoble things. When God made man at the beginning, he didn't use gold or silver to make us. He didn't even use iron to make us. He used dirt, the dust of the ground. When he used David to deliver Israel from the Philistines, he didn't use Saul's kingly armor. He used a slingshot and a little rock. When Jesus came, he didn't enter a family of wealth and prestige and nobility. He came to a peasant girl and was born in a stable. When he chose the 12, he didn't choose elite, educated, affluent men, but unlearned and ignorant Galileans. For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God hath chosen the foolish things to confound the wise, and the weak things to confound the things which are mighty. This is the way it's always been. God declares you and me, meager as we are, to be the salt of the earth. He wants to use us to hold back the judgment of the world and retard the corruption. And God gets the greater glory in the humbleness of the ones that he uses. I picked Israel because you were so little. Here there's 7 nations greater and mightier than you are, but I'm going to use you to drive them out. And everybody will know that it's me doing it, said God. God is interested in this type of thing. He gets the greater glory in the humbleness of the ones that he uses. Salt and light balance each other. Salt is more hidden. Salt just melts away into whatever it flavors or preserves. But light shines on the outside. Light is open. Light works visibly. We affect society's thinking and living by the power of our lives in both of these areas. We turn on the light so everybody can see the message that we're wanting to give. It isn't just in our words, but in our overt, open, godly conduct. We are both a subtle influence like the salt and a blatant influence like the light. Salt can't change corruption into incorruption. Salt can only retard the corruption. So that's a negative function. Salt holds back the corruption. We have to shine the light of the gospel to transform corruption into incorruption. So both of these are necessary. Verse 16 says, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." That implies that they have heard something about our Father which is in heaven, if they're going to glorify Him. It implies both a life and a message, lived and spoken. Which is more important, the Christian walk or the Christian talk? The Christian life or the Christian lip? They're like the two wings of an airplane, and they're both equally important, and without both wings, you won't get off the ground. Here's an interesting thing. In the very first book of the very first verse of the book of Acts, Acts chapter 1, verse 1, Luke writes, "The former treatise have I made, O Theophilus, of all that Jesus began both to" what? "Both to do and to teach." Those two things. To do and to teach. Ever and always, these two go together. The doing and the teaching. The living and the speaking. Living the righteous life and speaking the truth in love. God is light, 1 John chapter 1. And if we are light, we manifest God. Psalm 119, 105. "Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path." So God is light and the word is light. Jesus is the light that lights every man, John 1, 9. That's the light, then, that we shine on the world. Tell about God, tell about God's Word, and tell about God's Christ. 2 Corinthians 4, 6. "God, who first ordered the light to shine in the darkness, has flooded our hearts with His light." We can enlighten people only because God has first enlightened us. God passes the light down to us and through us. Philippians 2:14, "Do all things without murmurings and disputings, that you may be blameless and harmless, children of God without rebuke." Children of God without rebuke. If they're going to criticize us, then let them have to make something up, because there's nothing true that's bad about us that they can say. If we have to be hated, let's be hated like Christ, hated without a cause. "Blameless, harmless, children of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life." The light has to shine openly. A city that is set upon a hill cannot be hid. The villages in those days were built on the tops of the hills, for the most part. On the tops of the hills in that hot country, they could be better cooled by the breezes. On the tops of the hills, they could be more easily defended. And when night came and everybody lit a lamp in their house, it made the village just sparkle. And anybody walking through the night could easily find the village, because the lights sparkled like diamonds in the sky. A city on a hill could not be hidden. Light was for the purpose of shining forth openly. So we're not just subtle salt. We are also conspicuous, very conspicuous light. We're not masons in a secret society. We're not pagans with mysteries only for the initiated. We don't have a cult known only to a few. We're a city set on a hill, and the whole world ought to be able to see us. Now, we've talked about the presupposition in this passage in Matthew 5, 13 through 16. We've talked about the plan. Now we come briefly to the problem. The problem is that if sin enters our lives and we don't walk in the Spirit, we will stop being effective as salt and we will be useless as light. He says in verse 13, "If the salt has lost its saltiness, what good is it?" And the answer is that non-salty salt has no use. It's good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden underfoot of men. "Neither do men light a lamp and put it under a bushel, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house." There's no place for a secret Christian. And salt can lose its saltiness. The Greek word here means flat and tasteless. The salt in Jesus' day was not nearly as refined as the salt that we have now. And that's the reason for the confusion on this point, I think. This happened often in Jesus' day, that salt would lose its saltiness. The Dead Sea was and is a tremendous repository of salt. The salt was in abundance in the marshes and lagoons and on the rocks of the Dead Sea. And because it was mixed with gypsum and therefore impure, it easily acquired a stale or alkaline taste. That kind of salt would lose its capacity to salt. And the only thing it was good for was to throw out on the road where people walked. You couldn't throw it out in the fields or it would kill everything. So they threw it on the road where it would be trampled. Natural salt is impure in many cases, and then being mixed with other chemicals, it can become unsalty. William Thompson, in his classic work, The Land and the Book, which deals with the land of Israel, tells of a merchant who rented several houses in which he stored salt, and he forgot to cover the dirt floor before he dumped the salt in there. He put the salt down right on the dirt floor. And when he returned, he found that the salt had lost its flavor from being right next to the earth. Good analogy of the Christian who gets too close to the world, the salt losing its savor by that process. So this man threw the whole supply of salt out into the street, and it was trampled. There wasn't anything else you could do with it. It was just used like gravel on the road. The kind of salt they had at that time could lose its saltiness, and that's what the Lord is talking about. He also says in Luke 14:34, salt is good, but if the salt has lost its savor, with what shall it be seasoned? It's neither fit nor land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. It's amazing on this point how many commentaries say that Jesus was wrong here because salt can't lose its saltiness. But in Jesus' day, salt, as they knew it, certainly could lose its saltiness, and you and I can lose our saltiness too. If sin begins to dominate in our lives, we lose our saltiness, and with it, we lose our influence for good. You can't retard the corruption of the world when you're of the world. There's nothing to distinguish you from the world because you're just like them. You forfeit your influence, you lose your impact, and as Paul feared, you become a castaway. Just be sinful at work and notice how you lose the reputation that you may have built up for years for the Lord. Just be sinful at school and you lose your saltiness. You make no contribution then to retard the corruption. It's true that perfectly pure salt does not lose its flavor, but our problem is none of us are perfectly pure salt. While we're in this world, we've got impurities, and the potential for losing our saltiness will always be there. While we're here, that's why we need to guard against it. Now, the lamps that they used in their homes were often little terracotta-type lamps with a spout on one end and a handle on the other end and a wick floating in the middle of the oil. Often they would let them burn all night, just so if somebody needed to get up, there was a way for them to see. They weren't real bright, but collectively they produced quite a light. Remember the Proverbs 31 lady, her candle goeth not out by light. Tallow candles weren't invented until about 800 or 900 years ago in Great Britain. These lamps that are talked about in the Bible, Old Testament and New, are oil lamps, mainly like the one I'm describing here. Her candle goeth not out by night. Her lamp does not go out by night. You have to keep enough oil, and you have to be conscientious enough to keep it trimmed and lit. We've got this treasure in earthen vessels, but some Christians are like an Arctic river, frozen at the mouth. We need to get over that. Jesus was calling here for something that was brand new. He's telling these people, you are part of a religious system that's really fouled up. If you live according to the character of my kingdom, and the book of Matthew in its entirety is a manifesto of the kingdom. If you live according to the character of my kingdom, then you're really going to have to be different from the people around you. The fear of persecution makes us hesitant, whether it's a subtle persecution or a covert persecution. So he personalizes this in verse 16. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. There is a beauty. There is an attractiveness. There's a winsomeness to good deeds. He says, let the world see my beauty in you. The light is in you. You don't have to crank the light up or worry about getting the light started. All you have to do is let it go. Jesus Christ already lives in you. He is the light. All you got to do is allow him to shine through you. Won't let Satan it out, as we used to sing with the children. If you've got a basket of fear over your lamp, you need to just pull that basket off. If there's a basket of wanting to be acceptable to the world over your lamp, you just need to pull that basket off. If you got a basket of not wanting to offend people or not wanting to make waves, just got to take that basket off and let the Lord's light shine by the things you do and the things you say. You know, a lot of times in life, anticipation is worse than the actual event. If you just pull that basket off of the light and let the light shine, the results might not be nearly as bad, and they might be a lot better. They might really even be good compared to the way you think that they might be. Well, we said we were going to talk about the presupposition and the plan and the problem and the purpose. So now we've come to point number four, just for a last moment here. The purpose is the glorification of God, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father, which is in heaven. If the glory of God is not your priority, that means you're more concerned with yourself than you are with God's glory. But if your top priority is the glory of God, then you will be salt that is salty, and you will be a light that is manifest. You know, these people 2,000 years ago needed to hear the basics just like we still need to hear the basics. You who know the Bible need to hear this same old story again. We all need to think about these basic issues of Christian living and Christian telling. What about your influence? What is your influence like at this time? What happens when you walk by? We need to live and talk so that the world can see who God is by seeing what we are, and that they can see that we belong to Him. Today, who knows how many people have already passed on into the next world on this very day. Tomorrow, more people will pass on into the next world. It's happening every day. If you were to die tomorrow, would it be said of you that your life made a difference in the world? Sweep through the world as salt and as light and make a difference. We don't expect it to be easy. Truth be told, it's probably going to get harder, not easier, in our country. But just because the world makes it hard on us, we shouldn't hide or keep our mouths shut. God's plan is us. We are plan A through Z. We're the plan He's got. The way we change the world is not to go out and try to change it politically. The way we change the world is not to rewrite the laws or march or use a bunch of technological paraphernalia for altering society. The way we change the world is to infiltrate it with godliness, righteousness, and holiness and affect it from the inside out. Those other things I mentioned aren't wrong. It's just that they're powerless to change the world. The way to do it is the influence of godly people. Think about this. Why did England, at the end of the 18th century, not have a revolution like France had at the end of the 18th century? No revolution in England at that time, and a great revolution in France. The reason for the difference was that there were masses and masses of people in England who were living a different life than the people in France were living, for a number of different reasons. But they had a different outlook in England, and that altered the entire political situation just because of the way people were. The whole political life of the country was affected. Jesus looked at the city of Jerusalem, and He wept, saying, "How often I would have gathered you, but you would not." Let's not us cause more tears because we too have been unfaithful. May we each live to fulfill this marvelous command of our Lord. May God make us different, that the world may be different because we are. It appears that we may be called on in the days ahead to really stand up and be counted for His cause in our country. Hebrews 11 said to the people of that day in the first century, "You have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin." And we haven't either so far. We haven't been martyred yet. I don't know what the future holds, but I do know that we need to come to grips with our intentions right now. We need to prepare long before the bow is drawn against us. You've got one life. You've got one shot. You have chosen Christ and you love Christ. His word has penetrated your heart, and there is a price to pay when we commit to Him. He has already paid the supreme price for us. He has already borne the blows that should have been borne by us, so we can take the blows that the world means for us. We're the only salt and light, so let's be different and make a difference. I'm going to leave this lesson with you as we once again extend the Lord's invitation. If anybody is outside of Christ or has another need for the invitation, let us know how we can assist you by coming to the front while we stand together and sing the song that has been announced.